Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
His passport has been torn up in front of him. He's been isolated for lengths of time and then caged with 80 others at lengths of time. Ben Gavir yelled abuse at the detainees, calling them terrorists.
Seven Australians held in Israeli prisons after Gaza aid mission. We hear from a family member.
Is that it just increases price pressure going forward? And so two things happen. One, it's more difficult to buy a house in the future.
Government expands 5% deposit scheme, but experts warn it could worsen housing affordability. And later today...
Or maybe their disability post-stroke, and so it's really quite isolating for them.
New research explores stroke support needs for Australians' LGBTQI plus community. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Seven Australians are now confirmed to be in Israeli detention, taken by force from international waters, while participating in humanitarian flotilla bound for Gaza. The Global Sumud Flotilla, a civilian convoy carrying food, water and medical aid, was attempting to break the siege on Gaza when it was intercepted on October 2nd, some 70 kilometres off the coast. Now, the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has confirmed that those detained have been tortured, including Surya McGowan, a humanitarian worker from New South Wales. I spoke with Jessica Mamone, a friend of Surya and a part of his support team.
During his illegal detainment, has been reported by DFAT to have been subjected to being slapped. His head has been slammed onto the concrete ground. His arm has been dislocated. He's been subjected to threats of sexual abuse. His passport has been torn up in front of him. He's been isolated for lengths of time and then caged with 80 others at lengths of time. Ben Gavir yelled abuse at the detainees, calling them terrorists. He has likewise been subjected to sleep deprivation techniques. They've been woken repeatedly with guns in their faces and had dogs set on them. Numerous instances of physical intimidation. The water that they have been provided them has been undrinkable. It is tastes foul with a strong chemical taste. They're concerned that it has been drugged and or tampered with in some way. And if this is how Israel is treating Australian humanitarians, with the whole world watching and listening, then the mind boggles at how it's treating the 1,100-something illegally detained Palestinians that the world is currently ignoring.
While DFAT says it's providing counsel assistance, families say the response from the Australian government has been too slow and too quiet.
There has been no offers of assistance. There has been no offers of applying pressure or speaking with Israel or applying any type of diplomatic measures. There's been nothing. They've been completely left on its own.
The flotilla was a part of a coordinated global effort to break the blockade on Gaza, involving activists from over 40 countries. The boats were unarmed and clearly marked with humanitarian insignia. Talitha Mitchell, spokesperson for Global Movement to Gaza.
It's simply awful. It's very distressing what we have learned. There's just been so many breaches of international law, maritime law, human rights law.
Israel claims the flotilla possessed a security risk, but under international law, the blockade of Gaza has been widely condemned, with the United Nations and the International Court of Justice calling it unlawful and amounting to collective punishment. Since the flotilla was intercepted, over 70 Palestinians have been killed in the ongoing Israeli airstrikes. Talitha Mitchell says the mission was about saving lives, not confrontation.
We have to remember that no crimes have been committed by these civilians. They were sailing in international waters on a mission that is humanitarian. All they were carrying was food aid and hope for Gaza.
Legal experts say this constitutes torture and violates international law, including the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture.
Their interception and the hijacking of them on the high seas is a breach of maritime law and international law. So I think it's most important in this moment that our Prime Minister and Foreign Minister condemn these attacks. And you also have to remember that there were bombings of the flotilla as well. There were attacks before they were illegally abducted. So we have to condemn.
For Surya's supporters and his family, this is a nightmare, but it's also a test for the Australian government and its willingness to stand up for its citizens and international law. Jessica Mamone says the time for silence is over.
If we're not going to do anything now, then when are we going to act? And if we're not going to assess this from a human being perspective and solely focus on politics, then a poll was released today by YouGov stating that 57% of Australians want Australia to sanction Israel. And these actions will be remembered when it comes to vote next. The families are desperate. We were demanding that they protect our Australian citizens and, instead of being complicit, abide by international laws. We've appealed to everyone with access to a computer to be emailing their representatives, not just about the humanitarians, but for the whole reason that they went.
With global attention on both the detainees and the deepening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the next moves for the Australian government and its allies may determine the fate of both. This is Momina Shakur for The Wire. The federal government has expanded the 5% deposit scheme to help more first home buyers enter the property market. But economists warn it may push prices even higher and leave future buyers worse off. Sarah Jensens has the story.
For many young Australians, the possibility of owning a home feels impossible. The government's 5% deposit scheme aims to change that by allowing first home buyers to enter the market with the government acting as a guarantor. But as the scheme expands, economists are questioning whether it directly addresses Australia's housing crisis or simply pushes house prices up. Professor Sam Tsiaplias from the University of Melbourne says while the scheme helps some people in the short term, it doesn't solve the fundamental issue.
I think it is going to help some people enter the market. Essentially provides a basis for purchasing a home or an apartment or some dwelling by, I guess, eliminating the need to have a large deposit. So in effect, the government provides lenders mortgage insurance for a relatively small deposit that they would otherwise have to pay for. I guess the main issue is that the net effect of these types of schemes is that they increase demand. And so it may help some people in the near term purchase houses, but overall, the net impact is going to probably be a small price increase. So while it may help some people, it just, I guess, it accentuates or it perpetuates the positive price trend that house prices have. So it makes it more difficult for future buyers.
Tsiaplias notes that dwelling approvals have barely changed in the last 40 years, and the scheme faces supply constraints.
The key issue is that they do help in the short term, but the cumulative impact of all these demand side measures, particularly in the presence of supply side constraints, is that it just increases price pressure going forward. And so two things happen. One, it's more more difficult to buy a house in the future. And two, you need these schemes going forward as well, because those price pressures pushed forward generate the need for further schemes.
But not all economists see it in the same way. Associate Professor Adrian Lee from Deakin University believes the scheme could incentivize developers to build more homes.
I'd be looking at building approvals. So the fact that developers are seeing this as a positive and building more, the take up, and of course the take up of the scheme, and more importantly, where are people buying in this scheme? Is it in the growth areas or is it in existing areas?
But he warns that buyers entering the market with just a 5% deposit face significant financial risks.
If you have a 5% deposit, you're borrowing 95%. So there is an issue that they will be more burdened. The banks, of course, would try to only take borrowers that can service the loan. But it's pretty possible that they're going to be more burdened than, say, if you had a 20% deposit.
Both economists agree that protecting vulnerable buyers should be a priority, but the 5% deposit scheme might not be the solution. Professor Tsiaplias believes the focus should shift away from helping people buy homes and toward making alternatives to home ownership more secure.
I think rental reform is a key issue. Things such as longer term rents or increasing protections for renters, making rental a more viable alternative to, say, what it currently is, that would be, I think, beneficial, given that there are a large proportion of renters. So approximately 30% of people living in dwellings are renters, and at least relative to other areas, some of the protections they have are not as extensive as perhaps they should be, particularly in terms of the presence of a large proportion of very short-term rents. So 1 year is typically the rental agreement. And so increasing the rental tenure and increasing the rights that renters have is, I think, a useful alternative to these measures.
For now, the 5% deposit scheme offers a pathway into home ownership for some first home buyers. But whether it helps solve Australia's housing affordability crisis remains to be seen.
Professor Sam Tsiaplias from the University of Melbourne, ending that report by Sarah Jensens. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3 and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolaree in Broome, Western Australia. Over 440,000 Australians are living with a stroke, according to a study by the Stroke Foundation in 2023. And it highlights how often a patient requires medical support for the rest of their lives. But how can this support be catered for the LGBTIQ+ community living with a stroke? It's a question PhD candidate at the University of Sydney, William Cockay, is asking. Now, he's looking to research what LGBTIQ+ stroke survivors need for recovery regarding relationships, intimacy, sexual activity, and gender expression. The Wire's Natasha Bittencourt spoke with William Cockay about his research.
I'm researching post-stroke sexuality in LGBTQI+ populations.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what got you into studying that?
I work as a social worker and I work with a lot of people post-stroke. And I've had patients that were gay, trans, intersex, say to me that our like resources do not actually talk about what to do after stroke for our community. So I looked around and all the research doesn't actually include us, so yeah. I thought I might change that.
So what have you found so far?
So in our first study, we found that it actually does impact in a lot of similar ways to heterosexual populations. But the big thing is after stroke, they find it hard to get out to like Fair Day or nightclubs or even Mardi Gras. And they would normally go out to those events before, but they can't handle it due to, you know, their post-stroke fatigue or maybe their disability post-stroke. And so it's really quite isolating for them.
Have you found that there have been any ways that our community has made it accessible for them to access this or?
No. Yeah. It's interesting. One of my participants actually was part of World Pride, and World Pride did not have a disability plan at all.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And like, if you think about Mardi Gras in Sydney, any of the disability stalls are so inaccessible, and they are across grass with like potholes in, so they can't even access their own information.
Yeah, that's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so what are ways that we can make these events more accessible to post-stroke people in our community?
Yeah, what I saw today is there's a sensory tent, just so people that are neurodiverse or have a cognitive impairment can actually take time out, chill out in some quiet space before, you know, going around looking at the stalls again. Think about, you know, flat surfaces, so if someone's in a wheelchair, they can get around. So concreted areas are better. But also think about just ramped, not having stairs. Loud music is not the way to go, because like they need to think about walking, they need to focus on what's happening around them.
Yeah.
So any loud noise can actually impact.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Was
thank
there anything
you.
Else that you wanted to add that we didn't talk about?
Yeah, so we're currently recruiting for our new study, looking at what people need in rehab post-stroke. So, you know, you can always check out the information on our social media pages. So stroke LGBTI research and drop us a line.
PhD candidate at the University of Sydney, William Cockay there, speaking with The Wire's Natasha Bittenkirk. For more information about the research, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. Every 3 seconds, a girl is forced into child marriage, ending her education and putting her at risk of abuse. Around the world, nearly 1 in 3 women and girls face violence, and in developing countries, half of all girls don't finish primary school. The 1,000 Voices for 1,000 Girls campaign is back ahead of International Day of Girl Children on October 11. For the first time, both female and male celebrities are joining to support the cause. Yan Wang from The Wire spoke with Mel Carswell from World Vision about the campaign and the challenges girls face worldwide.
Every 3 seconds, a girl is forced into child marriage, which is such a horrific thing to think through. And that usually means that her education ends. And often with that, her chances of building a safe or an independent life. And also right now around the world, 122 million girls are out of school globally, which is so hard to comprehend. And of all the girls in the developing world, only half of them will ever finish primary school. And that's why the World Vision 1000 Girls campaign is so important, to raise the voices and to raise the issues facing these girls around the world.
So this year's 1000 Voices for 1000 Girls campaign, what makes this year's campaign different from previous ones?
Yeah, fantastic. So the 1000 Girls campaign is in its seventh year. It started right back in 2018. But this year, for the first time ever, we have both male and female ambassadors raising their voice for girls all around the world. We have a whole range of athletes, actors, musicians and media personalities, both male and female. People like Yelena Dokic or Alex Dimona or Rebecca Givney or TikTok star Eunice Wani, and they're all raising their voices for girls around the world.
So how will this 1000 Voice for 1000 Girls campaign practically support vulnerable girls?
So World Vision's work around the world helps girls to access their education, which is so important because we know that their life opportunities open up when they stay in school. It also helps them to be protected against early marriage or to be protected against any violence in the home or gender-based violence. It helps them to understand their rights and to know where to get help if they need it.
Australians are hearing this and may want to lend a hand. How can they get involved and show their support for girls at risk?
Oh, fantastic. We would love Australians to help vulnerable girls around the world. And the easiest and quickest way that they can do that is to sponsor a girl, to sponsor a child with World Vision today.
So, and where can people go to learn more about this campaign and or take actions right now?
Yeah, fantastic. They can go to worldvision.com.au and learn more about how to sponsor a child and the 1000 Girls campaign. Sponsoring a girl with World Vision is such an incredible thing to do. By sponsoring a child, whether it's a girl or a boy actually with World Vision, you help them get the skills and the tools that they need to overcome poverty and to strengthen their life, their family's life and their community as well. It helps them break free from poverty and it helps them understand their own rights as a human being and how they can advocate for themselves and others as well, specifically around vulnerable girls and the issues that they face. It helps them to know about child marriage, early child marriage. It helps them to understand about harmful practices that might happen that are harmful to girls and how they can stand up and fight against that for themselves and other girls in their community as well. Sponsorship broadly helps children access education, safe, clean water, helps them to have nutritious diets, helps their family to have the skills and tools to grow their income so that the family has a safety net as well and they're not forced into making really tough decisions, which might include, for example, a girl being married off really young or being sent to work as a child, which, again, we want to keep girls in school. We want to keep opening their opportunities and giving them choices for their adult life. So sponsorship is quite a game changer for vulnerable girls around the world.
Like, I'm curious about which area you are supporting for.
World Vision supports vulnerable girls all around the world in over 100 countries, specifically with sponsorship in just over 50 countries. And Australians who are wanting to sponsor a child can support vulnerable girls in different countries in Africa, across Asia, and in South America as well. A lot of the girls' stories that we raise in this campaign, I was there with some of my team when we captured those stories in different countries around the world. And to sit on the ground and talk with a girl who's been so broken and who's had her life completely turned upside down, perhaps by violence from somebody else or being forced into child marriage, it's so heartbreaking. And what I do love, though, is that World Vision is part of the hope and the optimism part of their story. Their life can be really broken for a season and or sometimes forever, but they come to our local staff for help and support, and we're always there for them. So personally, it's a really great thing to be a part of.
That was Mel Carswell, spokesperson for World Vision. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Y acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur coming to you from 4UB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company and we'll see you next time on The Wire.